Okay. Well, warm welcome and thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, the 19th of November. We have another very packed agenda. We have the situation in Lebanon. We have Ukraine. We have an update on the COP29. We also have an announcement to mark World Children's Day, which is tomorrow. We also have announcements from FAO and WHO on the Antimicrobial Resistance Awareness Week. So we have colleagues to speak on that, as well as a colleague from the ITU. So very, very packed agenda. Without further ado, I'm going to throw it to my colleague and friend, Andrea Tenenti, who's, as you know, the spokesperson for UNIFIL, the UN's peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, who's going to give us an update on the situation on the ground. And then I'm going to go immediately to James from UNICEF to also address Lebanon. So over to you, Andrea.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rolando, and thank you for hosting UNIFIL during this briefing. I will start with a few minutes of remarks that I hope then will be distributed to the media after the briefing. Since my last briefing over a month ago, tension across the Blue Line has increased, while hostilities continued with renewed intensity. Israeli ground incursions have entered deeper inside Lebanon. Ground clashes inside Lebanon are getting more violent, including some of them taking place very close to our positions. Daily Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon, as well as missile and drone attacks by Hezbollah into Israel, have caused widespread destructions of towns and villages on both sides of the Blue Line. Just giving a figure from the Lebanese Ministry of Public Health as of yesterday, more than 3,500 people have been killed and nearly 15,000 injured since the conflict started 1 year ago. Most of these casualties were recorded after the dramatic escalation that started 2 months ago. The International Organization for Migration has also recorded nearly 900,000 people displaced internally. It's estimated that more than 500,000 people of the total displaced are from UNIFIL area of operation, so almost 60%. Since the hostilities started last year, UNIFIL has also suffered numerous hits on its assets and personnel, a total of 162 impacts, with more than one third in less than 2 months. More than 20 peacekeepers have been injured so far. Fortunately, none of them has life-threatening conditions. UNIFIL has also been playing a crucial role in facilitating life-saving work of humanitarian actors in its area of operations, coordinating daily with IDF, LAF, as well with Lebanese authorities and humanitarian agencies. For example, in the last 4 months, UNIFIL has facilitated around 1,200 civilian and humanitarian activities in areas close to the Blue Line. Among the humanitarian activities include facilitating work of the Lebanese Red Cross, civil defense, humanitarian organizations, journalists, as well as force protection for UNIFIL and for the Lebanese army. UNIFIL Head of Mission and Force Commander, Lieutenant General Lazaro, continues to maintain an open channel of communication with the parties. The focus of his contacts is geared towards de-escalating tensions, recommitting the parties to Resolution 1701, and returning to the cessation of hostilities. The posture of our more than 10,000 peacekeepers from nearly 50 countries remain unchanged since the 23rd of September. We have not left our positions. All of them remain in all our 50 positions across the area of operations, monitoring and reporting the situation on the ground. UN Undersecretary General for Peace Operation Lacroix visited Lebanon and UNIFIL last week. One of the objectives of the visit was to show solidarity with UNIFIL peacekeepers and also meeting with Lebanese authorities before traveling to Israel. He also took the opportunity to renew calls for de-escalation and the return to the cessation of hostilities. I understand that Mr. Lacroix will be briefing New York at the noon briefing later on. Resolution 1701 has been significantly challenged in these 14 months. but its key provisions of safety, security, and long-term solutions remain valid, while its full implementation still remains one of the most viable political roadmap to peace. UNIFIL stands ready to support any framework the parties agree to end the hostilities. Thank you, and ready to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Andrea, for that very comprehensive overview. I'm going to throw right now to James Elder of UNICEF, and then we'll take questions after.
Thanks so much, Roland. Despite more than 200 children killed in Lebanon in less than 2 months, a disconcerting pattern has emerged. Their deaths are being met with inertia from those able to stop this violence. For the children of Lebanon, it's become a silent normalization of horror. Now, in an effort to break that, we just want to go back just simply over the last 10 days in Lebanon for children. Sunday, November 10, 7 children were killed from an extended family. The family of 27, who were all killed, were seeking shelter in Mount Lebanon after fleeing violence in the south. On Monday, 2 more children were killed with their mother, 10 were injured. On Tuesday, 13 children were killed, 13 more were injured, including an 8-year-old boy, Ahmed, who is now the sole surviving member of his family. On Wednesday, 4 children were killed, again having sought to flee violence in the south. On Thursday, 3 children were killed, 13 were injured. Last Saturday, 16 November, 5 children were killed, including 3 from the same family. Among the injured there was Celine Hadar, a young football player with the Lebanese national football side. She's currently in a coma from shrapnel to her head. And on Sunday, twins, 4-year-old girls, were killed. Indeed, over the last 2 months in Lebanon, an average of 3 children have been killed every single day. Of course, many more have been injured, many more traumatized. Now, we must hope that humanity never again allows the ongoing level of carnage of children in Gaza. Though there are chilling similarities for children in Lebanon. One, the hundreds of thousands of children who've been made homeless in a very, very short period of time, the last 6 weeks in the country. Two, the disproportionate attacks, many of which are hitting infrastructure on which children rely. So medical facilities have been attacked, health workers are being killed at an increasing speed. As of November 15, more than 200 health sector workers had been killed and 300 injured, all according to Lebanon's Ministry of Health. Third, despite efforts in November to open some schools and get children back into learning, given the widespread attacks over the past weekend, all schools are again closed. The fourth chilling similarity to Gaza, the grave psychological impact on children. Again, we are seeing alarming signs of emotional turmoil across child populations. And perhaps the most worrying parallel to Gaza, the escalation of children being killed is eliciting no meaningful response from those with influence. Now, as UNICEF seeks to tackle this humanitarian crisis, we've provided tens of thousands of blankets, of sleeping bags, of mattresses, of hygiene kits, meals, showers, toilets. That's all for the displaced. When we talk about 400,000 children displaced, I think there can be a sense that displacement means being moved for one another. Displaced, it's quite a gentle word. Of course, displacement for a child involves a very tumultuous upheaval, usually amid violence, and then the great irony, they then find themselves in classrooms as a last line of resort, sleeping in classrooms, not learning in classrooms. Our work has meant 450,000 people again have access to safe water. We are providing psychosocial support to children. We are supplying tons and tons of medical support to a health system under attack. All of this despite the fact that UNICEF's latest appeal is less than 20% funded. And as the attacks intensify, so too does the level of need. Indeed, in Lebanon, much the same that is the case in Gaza, the intolerable is transforming into the acceptable. The appalling is slipping into the realm of the expected. And once more, the cries of children go unheard. The world's silence grows deafening, and again we allow the unimaginable to become the landscape of childhood, a horrific and unacceptable new normal.
Thank you very much, James. It's very hard to hear this. I can't imagine what it's like for the people on the ground to endure this, but we'll take questions now and we'll start with any questions in the room, perhaps, before we turn online. We have Emma of Reuters, and if you can kindly just indicate who you're pointing your question to. Emma.
It's for UNIFIL, please. I had a question after on Gaza for UN agencies generally. Let me know if this is the time. Probably not, but let me know. The first one, there have been some reports of some governments, including Argentina, withdrawing troops from UNIFIL. I believe they were officers. Have you had any withdrawals since the escalation 2 months ago? And is this impacting your operations at all? Thank you.
Thanks. Andrea?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your question. Yes, correct. Argentina has asked their officers to go back. There are three Argentinian officers in UNIFIL. So our capabilities, operational capabilities, have not changed. All the other contingents, all the other troop contributing countries have shown their commitments to stay, especially after we were asked months ago by the IDF to move from our positions close to the blue line. Was a unanimous decision from everyone to remain, to stay. So we are still there in all our 50 positions in a very difficult situation. As I said, it's important to stay, to be there, to monitor, to assist as much as we can the population in South Lebanon and be here also for the future of UNIFIL. So nothing has changed. No other countries have asked to withdraw their peacekeepers from UNIFIL.
Thanks. Follow up, go ahead.
Thank you. Did they say why?
No, they did not. I just saw the cable and just asked to the return. I think that's maybe a question would be maybe good to ask to them, to the Argentinian authorities.
Thanks for that, Andrea. Further questions in the room before we go online? No, that's not the case. So we'll turn that to Musa of Al Mayadeen. Musa.
Merci, Your Honor. My question for UNIFIL, can you please tell us about the size of the areas occupied by Israel since the beginning of the current war, the villages, and the distance from the blue line? And I have a question for UNICEF. When we said 200 children killed in Lebanon, this is from the beginning of the war in October 23, or just from 2 months? Thank you.
Andrea?
Yes. Yeah, thank you. The difficult to say because our monitoring capabilities have been very limited, but we did see incursions have entered deeper inside Lebanese territories. Not sure how many kilometers, but like 2 or 3 kilometers inside, but not permanently. So then they withdraw, they go back to their positions. So there have been entering deeper inside the territory, but not permanently. The destruction, nevertheless, has been huge, shocking what we see across the blue line, along the blue line in villages like Kafirkila, Marun Arras, and others that have been completely destroyed by the incursions of the IDF in these areas. But as I said, our monitoring capabilities have been very limited because of the ongoing shelling. But we have seen entering deeper inside Lebanese territories. But as I said, also going back after their military operation.
Yeah, thanks. No, the number of just over 200 is just in the last 2 months. It's at least 231 since the start of the war last year. Again, in the last 2 months, it's around just over 1,100 injured children. Just briefly to give a sense of that, because it's not, you can't overlook children being killed, but the attacks on children. When I was in Lebanon last week and was in a hospital and seeing a little girl who was wounded, it's a six-year-old girl, Sawsan, S-A-W-S-A-N, and she's just lying there, but just all the back of her hair shaven because of the shrapnel in her head, not moving in the slightest, cannot walk, cannot speak, cannot hear. And what do you say? All you can hear in her room is just her gritting of her teeth because she's in such pain and she has some mental issues, psychological mental issues now, brain injury. But I asked her mum, how was she before this? And her mother showed me a photo of her a month earlier, and it's a six-year-old girl with pink hair, braids and dancing like any of you know a six-year-old girl. So, you know, when we talk of 1,100 wounded, injured children in the last 2 months, this is what we mean when we say attacks on childhood.
Thank you both. We'll take a question up from, well, let's maybe take a question back in the room and then we'll go to Nick afterwards. Agnes of AFP.
Yes, thank you. So this would be a question to James Elder from UNICEF about those more than 200 children killed in Lebanon in less than 2 months. Could you be a little more specific about in which circumstances and if you are pointing any of the parties who has killed the majority of them? Thank you.
Yeah, UNICEF, given where we work, given our frontline, given we work with state actors and non-state actors, we don't name, but anyone who follows the media should have a fairly strong indication of how these children have been killed, where the rockets have been fired from, where these children were, where they were fleeing, where they're the same as Gaza.
Thank you again. Now we'll turn to Nick of New York Times, and we'll go back to you, Jeremy, afterwards. Nick?
Yeah, thank you for UNIFIL question. I just want to check, how much of the south is still populated? Do you have an estimate of the number of Lebanese still living in southern areas? Secondly, is UNIFIL still able to maintain patrols in the blue zone, or is the presence of Israeli troops essentially restricting that? And are you, you've had several observation towers that have been attacked. Are these being replaced? Is your capacity, your monitoring capacity still the same? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. In terms of population in the south, as I said, the usual population in South Lebanon in our area of operation is around 600,000 people, and over 500,000 have left. So really few, and maybe more than 500,000. So the figures I had was a little bit over 50, 60,000 people left in South Lebanon. So, and they're still in need of assistance. So that's the figures we have. In terms of monitoring capability, as I said, very limited because of the ongoing conflict. We are able to do some operational activities along the blue line, logistical support, trying to assist also humanitarian agency to bring assistance to the local population. But as James was mentioning before, some similarity with Gaza and the fact that we cannot ensure the safety and security of the convoys because safety and security is not granted. So we try to do whatever we can, our utmost to provide the support, but has been very difficult. The same for providing monitoring activities, but it's important to be there and to be able to provide this information to the Security Council. Our towers and our some of our positions have been attacked and heavily damaged. We have been able to repair most of them. We are still working on fixing some of the positions, but this has been definitely a very difficult moment because we have been also deliberately attacked by the IDF in recent months. And we are doing our utmost to rebuild the areas and the places and T-walls that have been destroyed by these attacks.
Thank you, Andrea. I should mention, since you mentioned the Security Council, I note that the Security Council will hold consultations behind closed doors on the situation in Lebanon this afternoon, New York time. Jeremy, you had a question at FE.
Hi, James. Talking about the casualties, you mentioned the similarities for children in Gaza and Lebanon. Yet, maybe the difference is that you don't have famine yet in Lebanon. I'd like to know, among those 231 children, are you starting to see casualties because of other consequences than direct attacks, meaning lack of healthcare, lack of food, lack of water, lack of hygiene, lack of, you know, are you seeing those yet in Lebanon, or is it yet to come?
No, thankfully we're not. There is no doubt the poly crisis, if you will. I mean, I spoke to people who've had their home destroyed who also saw their pension 5 years ago, you know, be reduced by 99% in the economic collapse. So people have been hit in ways that, that most of us hope we never experience one of those crises, and they've had three or four. No, the health system is very strong. Organisations, WHO, UNICEF, supply it, you know, with in a robust way. But we have seen again this continuous and ongoing or escalating attacks on services that children rely on, water points particularly. So at the moment we're able to respond accordingly, and aid distribution is not anywhere like Gaza. But again, these signs. And I think it was interesting listening now. One of the other parallels, talking to colleagues on the ground over the weekend who were very shaken by the big attacks in central Beirut, people talking about nowhere is safe. And this again just becomes a phrase that we use very, very easily now, as if nowhere is safe. Of course, we started talking about it a year ago to really explain, despite the statements made, that nowhere in Gaza is safe. And we've known that. Families now know that. That's why children are being killed everywhere. That's becoming the case in Lebanon. The front line shifts everywhere. Families are moving. They're told to move. They don't know where to move to. So it's important we sit on this phrase, nowhere is safe, for a moment and understand what that means to a family who's lost a home and is living in a shelter, but doesn't that shelter does not represent any form of real safety to them.
Thank you very much, James and Andrea. Jamie, question, AP.
Hi, Mr. Tenenti. Thank you for coming back to see us. I'm Jamie from Associated Press. I wanted to just ask you, you sort of alluded to the answer, you sort of answered my question in responding to Nick, but I guess my real question is, given the circumstances on the ground right now in southern Lebanon, how much consideration is actually being given, and in light of what the Argentinians are doing, how much consideration is being given to the possibility of a broader drawdown of forces in UNIFIL to in the current state of affairs? I understand that, you know, in times of relative peace compared to right now, UNIFIL has a very important role. But given the heat of the conflict right now, how much consideration is being given to the possibility of drawing down or pulling back into from your positions? And if you could just also give us a little bit of a flavor as to what might be said today to the Security Council if UNIFIL is going to be presenting. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Jamie. And I think it was very clear 2 months ago when the IDF asked UNIFIL to withdraw from all their positions close to the blue line. And the answer was immediately a no. We are staying. There was a strong support from commitment from all the troop contributing countries, from the Security Council, and also a strong support also for the mission when we have been attacked deliberately several times. So the idea is to stay. So there is no discussion of withdrawing at all. So we are here not only because we need to be here to monitor and to be present and to do as much as we can to support humanitarian organizations to assist the local populations, but also for the day after, to see what will be the role of the mission. We are ready to support any agreement that can be decided by both sides, and that's why we are here. So there is no discussion of withdrawing. We're still here in very difficult and challenging situation, especially for peacekeepers and positions close to the blue line, where they're really having very difficult conditions, especially now that the weather is that we are entering into winter. In relation to the Security Council, I really we have to wait for the Security Council to meet and for USG Lacroix and also UNSCOL to brief the Council I have at the moment no much information, but we have to wait for this afternoon.
Thank you, Andrea. And I'm sorry, Nick, I think you had you wanted some further clarification on your previous question, yes?
Yeah, thanks.
Go ahead.
Well, it's actually a follow-up very similar to Jamie's question there, in the sense that Mr. Tenenti, could you just give us a word on who Mr. Lacroix saw in Israel? And if you could just sort of say, did he get any reaffirmation of an Israeli willingness to comply with 1701? Was there any tangible outcome that you can allude to at this point? Thank you.
Well, I can just say that 1701 remains the main framework for any peace agreement negotiations. I'm not going to preempt Mr. Lacroix's briefing later on in New York at the noon briefing. So I will leave this to up to him to answer questions and brief the media on his recent trip to Lebanon. And to Israel.
Nick, is that still your hand up, or is that from before?
Yeah, could you just tell us who he met in Israel? I mean, was he meeting Minister of Defense? Did he meet Mr. Netanyahu? Can we at least see what the level of engagement was?
Yeah, I think I don't have much information. That's a question to be asked to New York right now. I know that he met with people from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and also with the IDF, and that's what he did, also going to the north of Israel. But details about all his visits will be something that he will brief all of you in a few hours, I guess.
Exactly. I think it's 3 p.m. New York time, so that's 9 p.m. here in Geneva. I think we've exhausted the questions on Lebanon. So with that, big thanks to you, Andrea. Thank you. And please do join us anytime here for this briefing. And thanks again to you, James. I know that you need to run. I haven't forgot you, Emma. We have a question on Gaza. We do have some briefers online as well as some in the room. But let's take your question since it's in the same region. Go ahead, Emma. Thanks again, Andrea.
Thank you. Maybe James or maybe WHO would be best placed to answer. As you probably know, there was a big looting incident, maybe the biggest since the war began over the weekend in Gaza. And I'm wondering if you have managed to get in any aid since that incident. How worried are you, and how is it affecting your planning? Thank you.
Thanks, Emma. No aid since then. How worried? For a long time. We have spoken about a whole range of issues more times than I can recall, which have resolved, have focused around more entry points, more consistency when it comes to delays and denials, more roads within Gaza. More roads within Gaza would help security. More security on the ground in Gaza. Once you create a level of desperation, and as has in Gaza, then there is no obvious police force there. But as we all know, the legal responsibility for the safe distribution of aid in Gaza does remain with Israel as the occupying power. We have not seen that. We haven't seen the entry points. We haven't seen the access. We've seen a war of words. I mean, truth has been a casualty of this war from the very beginning, but history will be very clear on actions actually taken. But for me, having been to Gaza quite a few times and sat with colleagues and been on convoys, the evidence is very, very clear on what needs to be done. And it's been clear time and again. We've seen that from the highest levels of advocacy. And each time we've seen little or no action, certainly no meaningful action. And now we have situations like this at the onset of winter. I mean, last month in October, around 10% of the supplies for the shelter cluster got to those people in the north coming through their second winter. So those people have been displaced three or four times. Again, that word displacement, living in a tent, the tents are ripped. They've lost blankets as they've moved, so there is a grave lack of winter supplies for people in the south, and of course a lethal lack of nutritional and medical supplies for people under siege in the north.
Thank you very much, James. I know you need to go, so thank you again. And Margaret wanted to chime in on this point. Margaret.
Yes, indeed. It's a really important question. We are very, very concerned. It's getting harder and harder to get the aid in. It's getting harder and harder to get the specialist personnel in at a time when there is greater and greater need. We are particularly concerned about Kamal Adwan Hospital. There are still 78 patients there, including 58 adults. Of them, there are 6 in intensive care unit, and there are 14 children in there. There's a lack of food and drinking water, shortage of medical supplies. There's really only enough for 2 weeks at very best, but a lot of the specific supplies are just not there. There's a lack of medical staff. There's only one paediatrician and one resident orthopaedic volunteer doctor. Between the 8th to the 16th November, 4 missions were WHO missions we tried to get up to go were denied. And the 9th and 10th missions on the 9th and 10th were only for, they only, it was only permitted for us to deploy an emergency medical team. We wanted to also provide fuel and supplies and water, but we were only allowed to do patient referral and delivery of supplies, but we were not allowed to bring fuel. So we urgently need to be able to bring in the correct aid to do the work, to keep Kamal Adwan Hospital functional. And that means regular, unobstructed access, not arbitrary denials. Just as James said, the denials are arbitrary. It's impossible to plan. It's impossible to bring the things in. And we need to be able to bring in the emergency medical teams. There are wonderful people who are willing to risk a very dangerous situation to help those children, but we're not being able to get them in.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Before we move to Ukraine, do we have any other questions on Gaza or the Middle East? No? Okay. Well, I know we're going to come back to you, Margaret, in a bit. You're welcome to stay here or go back as you like, but we're going to go now to Ukraine and then COP and then back to Margaret and a colleague from WHO to mark Children's Day. But let's go right now to Jeremy Lawrence of the UN Human Rights Office for an update on Ukraine as we mark 1,000 days since the Russian armed attack. Jeremy.
Thanks, Rollo, and good morning, everyone. Today marks the grim milestone of 1,000 days since the Russian Federation launched its full-scale armed attack on Ukraine. Our office has verified that at least 12,162 civilians have been killed since the 24th of February 2022, among them 659 children. At least another 26,919 civilians have been injured. Over the past 2 days, at least 30 civilians have reportedly been killed in a series of deadly strikes in residential areas in Sumy City, Odessa, and Kharkiv. In the very latest attack in Kharkiv, which occurred late last night, 9 civilians, including a child, were reportedly killed and 11, including 2 children, injured. Search and rescue operations are ongoing. On Monday, the head of the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, Daniel Bell, visited several locations in Zaporizhzhia that had been struck by Russian glide bombs. These carry large amounts of explosive material which, when deployed in cities and other populated areas, cause extensive civilian casualties and damage to civilian property. Among the sites visited was an oncology centre hit by a glide bomb on the 7th of November at 2:30 p.m., where cancer patients were undergoing chemotherapy at the time of the attack. The medical centre sustained severe damage and is now undergoing repairs. Bell also visited the site of an apartment building where half of the structure was destroyed by another glide bomb, also on the 7th of November. In this incident, 10 people lost their lives. Colleagues in our human rights monitoring mission in Ukraine later spoke with a man whose home had been destroyed after two vehicles thrown through the air by the blast wave on the same day struck his house. Next door, a family suffered a devastating loss. Their 20-year-old son was killed in the attack. His mother, who was severely injured, remains in hospital. The family's two-story home, the largest in the neighbourhood, was almost completely levelled by the glide bomb's direct impact. As the High Commissioner has said, it has been 1,000 days too many of senseless pain and suffering. Violations of human rights have become the order of the day, both in the conduct of hostilities and in areas under occupation. We call on all parties to ensure the safety and protection of civilians. Effective measures must also be taken to fully and impartially investigate where there are credible allegations of violations. The violence must stop for the sake of the people of Ukraine, the people of Russia, and the world. The High Commissioner repeats his call on the Russian Federation to cease immediately its armed attack and to withdraw all of its military forces from Ukraine. Russia must meet its international obligations under the UN Charter, the order of the International Court of Justice, and other applicable law.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. And I just draw your attention to the statement that we did share with you yesterday from the Secretary General to the Security Council that was actually delivered on his behalf by Rosemary DiCarlo, who's Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs. And as we just heard, the Secretary General echoed very strongly those comments about significant increase in civilian casualties over the last 2 months alone, noting that October and November saw some of the most intense and large-scale missile and drone attacks during the war. And this is all contained in the statement that we shared with you yesterday. We have a question from Christiane, front row, a German news agency.
Hello, Jeremy. I understand that the 12,000 deaths are verified. Can you give us an estimate? What do you think, what percentage is that of the actual figure?
That's a hard question to answer. 1,000 days is a long time where there are obviously people missing. This is obviously just the first figure that we can provide, and we will continue the verification process. But for sure, you're talking more, probably a lot more.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Jamie, AP.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for coming to see us. I wanted to just ask you, over the last 1,000 days, we've had any number of times people like you from the Human Rights Office and others calling on Russia to respect international law, calling for an end to the violence. Is there anything right now that gives you hope that this might be coming to an end?
Jamie, we've always got hope. It's obviously, I think, the testimonies that I shared today from Danielle are obviously dire, the situation, but we have an international system. We're sitting here today as with my colleagues from the UN, and we will continue to speak out when there are violations and remind states of their obligations, whether it be under the UN Charter or whether it be applying the standards set by international humanitarian law or human rights laws. So we will continue to speak up when we need to, in the hope that, yes, we will have influence and we will persuade states to stop the violence and to abide by their obligations.
Maybe just to also remind you, I mean, for 1,000 days now, the Secretary General and colleagues have been saying that the war must end, that this untold suffering of the Ukrainian people needs to come to an end. And this is something we've been saying, you know, without pause for 1,000 days now. So it's absolutely abhorrent that this situation is continuing as such. So thank you very much. I think we have one more question, actually, before we turn to the next subject. Antonio of EFE.
Thank you very much. So I want to ask if you are concerned about even more escalation of hostilities, more effects for civilians in Ukraine now that President Biden has given Ukraine permission to strike targets in Russia, and just today Russia in response to that has updated its nuclear doctrine.
If I may just echo what other colleagues within the UN have already said, the protection of civilian lives, civilian objects, civilian infrastructure has to be the priority in the conduct of any all hostilities. It's simple as that. The use of weapons in conflict must prioritise the prevention of harm to civilians. That's first and foremost.
Thank you. Actually, we do have one more question. Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, hello, Jeremy. Thank you. This isn't, in fact, on Ukraine. It's on Hong Kong. I wanted to ask if OHCHR has a reaction to the sentences that have just been handed out to in Hong Kong. And secondly, I'd like to ask what these sentences tell us about the effectiveness of the dialogue that Mr. Volker Turk has been maintaining with the Chinese authorities in terms of producing any improvement in human rights. Thank you.
Yes, Nick, I can give you a response. So we, as in the UN Human Rights Office, along with UN special procedures, have repeatedly brought the cases of the Hong Kong 47 and of Jimmy Lai to the attention of the government of China, including directly with the Hong Kong authorities. We are gravely concerned by the use of these security laws and the breadth to criminalise conduct protected by human rights to freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. Beyond the large numbers of accused directly impacted by criminal proceedings, these laws have major chilling effects on others in Hong Kong SAR, including the media, political dissidents, legislators, human rights defenders, lawyers, students, academia, bloggers, and artists.
Thank you. Yes, Jeremy. Well, thank you so much, Jeremy, and thanks for the question, Nick. I don't see, well, nothing on Ukraine, and maybe, yeah, go ahead, on Hong Kong. Yeah, go ahead, Jamie.
Jeremy, I think if I understood Nick's question correctly, also he alluded to the High Commissioner in your office's communications with Beijing. Can you address that issue? I mean, you know, there has been some serious concerns in the advocacy community that the arrangement that you've set up with the Chinese government is not bearing any fruit. And does this these sentences in Hong Kong now testify to the fact that your channels of communication are not being effective?
Thanks, Jamie. We will continue to engage with the Chinese authorities as we have done in the past. Nothing changes in that respect. Having said that, as I said earlier, we are gravely concerned by the use of this security law.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. I think we will now stay with you on a different subject entirely. Before we come to you, Margaret, I know we have a few other briefers as well as lined up for you, but Jeremy is going to give an update on the COP29 and the urgent need for human rights-based climate action. So, Jeremy.
Thanks, Rollo. With COP29 in Baku now in its second and final week, the UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk has reiterated his call for urgent human rights-based climate action. We need COP29 to mobilise trillions, not billions, of dollars in climate finance to keep the increasing global average temperature under 1.5 degrees Celsius and to catalyse more ambitious national climate commitments. We should expect and demand that those that have contributed the most to climate change to date pay more. Those most affected by climate change must have the funds they need to build resilience to climate change as well as access to effective remedy. These are urgent human rights priorities. This makes it all the more concerning that there has been a discernible lack of progress on many vital issues so far at COP29, and even some efforts to backtrack on previously agreed human rights language. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights stresses that the COP29 negotiations are about our collective future. The choice is stark. Remain on the current devastating trajectory for the planet and humanity, or work for a rapid, equitable, and just transition to sustainable economies and societies with human rights at their core.
Thank you very much. Very important messages indeed. Thanks, Jeremy. Do we have questions on this subject for Jeremy? No, I don't see that's the case. So thank you once again for those three briefings. Very important indeed. And now it's time for me to come back to Margaret, who's going to introduce her colleague and our guest from the WHO. So Margaret, over to you.
Thanks very much. I'm delighted to bring Dr. Martina Penizzato, who you haven't met before, but she leads on something really important. It's finding the right formulations for children's medicines. You may or may not know this, but there is a serious lack of that. So while we've heard of the awful things that are being done to children, there are also some very good things we can do for children. Over to you, Dr. Penizzato.
Thank you very much, and it's really a great opportunity to share with you today a few of the numbers and a little bit the situation that we're facing with providing medicines to children. Because we know that despite the progress in reducing child mortality, there is still a substantial lack of medicines that children face globally. That is because the medicine might not be approved for use of children, they might not be available in age-appropriate formulations, or they might simply not be available where they need to be used. So I know that everyone has been a child, so we all know that children are not small adults. We know that they can't take capsules, they can't necessarily swallow big tablets. And so what we need is really formulations that are adaptable to them. We need a formulation that can be sprinkled, that can be crushed, that can be dissolved in water or in breast milk, so that these children can, in fact, take the medicines that they need. I'll give you a few figures just to give you a bit of a size of the issue that we're facing. We know that today a child can wait 10 years, and in the case of cancer, even 20 years, before a novel medicine approved for an adult is actually available in age-appropriate formulations for children. We also know that less than 10% of the research and development work that the pharmaceutical sector leads on addresses the needs of children. And that triggers an issue that it's not just of low middle income countries, but affects all children globally. For example, in the antibiotic space, the WHO antibacterial pipeline that was published recently showed that we're not doing enough for children, and only 6 out of the 32 antibiotics that are in the pipeline are actually being investigated in children, leaving 3 million newborns every year getting sepsis and potentially risking their life because of antimicrobial resistance. The gap is even greater when we think about neglected tropical diseases, where less than a half of the treatment that are available for adults are actually investigated and approved for children. If you look at visceral leishmaniasis, for example, half of the population affected by this disease is in children. Yet the formulations that we have available are capsules or injectables that are very difficult to administer to children that are malnourished and have very poor muscle mass. I think we need to remember, though, that when these formulations, better formulations are developed, often they also don't get to countries as they should. For example, looking at the essential medicine list for children that WHO updates every 2 years, we can see that very few countries adopt this list. And even when they do, they very rarely mention pediatric formulations. And so there's really greater action that needs to happen at the country level to ensure that essential medicines are available for children. Now, can we do this differently? Is there a brighter future ahead of us? Yes, there is, because we know that a number of stakeholders have done work on this, have focused on key projects that have been tremendously important for a number of disease areas. But what we need now is those stakeholders to join forces, to work together, and we need new investments. We at WHO have recommitted to this area of work by launching the Global Accelerator for Pediatric Formulations back in 2020, which is a WHO network that gathers more than 30 partner organizations and that is there to unlock barriers, promote collaboration, and ensure that we can more rapidly investigate, develop, and introduce better medicines for children. So ahead of World Children's Day, we as GAPF partners very much call on investment and greater action and greater collaborative action around the world to make sure that children have access to the medicines that they need. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Very, very important messages indeed. Do we have questions for our colleague from WHO? No, I don't see that's the case. You were very comprehensive, and thank you very, very much. And I didn't see you in the front row there, Christine. Sorry. Go ahead.
I have a question, but not on this topic.
On another, okay, let's just make sure we have no questions on this subject before we take yours. Okay, go ahead, Christian, over to you.
The generalities about the meeting.
Sure. As you know, what Christian's referring to is the Emergency Committee on the MPOX, Public Health Emergency of International Concern, and under the international health regulations, that committee meets every 3 months after we've declared a public health emergency of international concern to look at the issues and decide whether or not that situation continues and to look at new recommendations. So indeed, they will meet on Friday. The meeting starts at officially 1 p.m. and goes basically until a decision is made, usually, but generally ends around 5 o'clock. Now, we have been discussing among ourselves, and we'd very much like to give you a result by Friday, because indeed, you don't want to have to hang around for the whole weekend. So the aim is to give you a result, but I promised that we'd have something at the end of INB last Friday, and we didn't. So that is the aim, but I'm not going to set it in concrete.
Is it a virtual meeting? Or?
It's a virtual. A virtual and in the room, hybrid. Most of the emergency committee meetings are pretty much online because we aim to have people from all around the world attending.
To maximize participation.
Exactly.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Margaret. Any further questions for WHO? No? Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Penizzato, for joining us here. And I'll come back anytime. And thanks for sending the notes. We're going to stay in the health sector, colleagues. We have briefers from FAO and WHO as well. Well, actually, yes, you're going to stay here with us, of course. Thank you. We have Xuncha Song, who's FAO's Senior Animal Health Officer, and addressing World AMR Awareness Week. What is AMR? It's actually antimicrobial resistance. And we also have a colleague from WHO who's going to brief us, Dr. Philip Matthew. But first, Xuncha, over to you. And joining us from Rome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, everyone. And thank you all for being here during World AMR Awareness Week. a time to spotlight one of the most pressing challenges of our time, antimicrobial resistance, AMR. AMR occurs when bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites becoming resistant to medicine, making infections harder or even impossible to cure. The silent crisis doesn't just threaten human health, it impacts animals, agriculture, and the environment. The misuse and overuse of antimicrobials in agriculture production, whether in livestock, aquaculture, or crops, accelerates the spread of resistance. Resistant microbes can spread through value chain and also their environment, creating ripple effect that endanger global health and food security. This year's UN General Assembly high-level meeting on AMR reinforced the urgency of action. FAO played a leading role in implementing the declaration adopted during the meeting, emphasizing sustainable solutions to safeguard food systems. As part of this effort, FAO reduced the need for antimicrobials on farms for sustainable agri-food system transformation, RenoFarm, a 10-year initiative as helping farmers to reduce antimicrobial use through sustainable practices. FAO AMR surveillance system called InFarm is gathering global data on AMR and agri-food systems to guide evidence-based actions. Tackling AMR requires a comprehensive One Health approach that connects human, animal, plant, and the environment health. FAO, alongside with UNEP, WHO, and WHO, is driving coordination efforts to reduce reliance on antimicrobials while protecting livelihoods and ecosystem. World AMR Awareness Week is your opportunity to take action. As a journalist, you play a pivotal role in forming the public and driving changes. Use your platforms to raise awareness, highlight a solution, and inspire leaders to uphold their commitments. This week, explore the stories of farmers' innovation to reduce antimicrobial use, communities affected by AMR, and global collaboration tackling this crisis. Together, we can ensure that antimicrobials remain effective tool for future generations, protecting both public health and our food system. AMR is a global challenge, but through awareness and action, we can build a safer, more sustainable future. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Ms. Song. We'll now turn to Dr. Philip Matthew of WHO, who's a technical officer, AMR Awareness Campaigns and Advocacy. So over to you, Dr. Matthew.
So thank you so much, and good morning to all. As my colleague Jung Sia mentioned, AMR makes antimicrobial medicines become ineffective and infections become difficult or impossible to treat. And we see an increase in disease spread, severe illness and disability, and also death. There were 1.27 million deaths directly attributable to AMR in 2019 alone. And according to a recent publication in The Lancet, that number could rise to 1.91 million by 2050. AMR threatens our ability to treat common infections and to perform life-saving procedures, including cancer chemotherapy, cesarean sections, hip replacement, organ transplantation, and other surgeries, and also procedures. The cost of inaction would be serious for the global economy. AMR is expected to escalate health expenditures, with the total expenses related to treating antimicrobial-resistant bacterial infections alone projected to reach $412 billion annually by 2035. Increased morbidity and mortality from these infections will lead to lower workforce participation and productivity losses to the tune of $443 billion per year, again by 2035. But it's actually a best buy. Investing in AMR is expected to give us a return of between $7 and $13 for every $1 invested. As Jung Sia mentioned, during the second UN General Assembly high-level meeting on AMR, the world leaders approved a political declaration which was quite ambitious. There was a commitment to reduce the deaths associated with bacterial AMR annually by 10% by 2030. The Jeddah commitments from the just concluded fourth ministerial conference on AMR reiterate the need for strengthened country-level action, with actions including establishing an independent panel for evidence on action against AMR by 2025. The World AMR Awareness Week was launched in 2015 to engage critical stakeholders and raise awareness among the public. The theme for 2024 is Educate, Advocate, Act Now, and the theme calls on the global community to educate the critical stakeholders on AMR, advocate for bold commitments, and take concrete actions in response to AMR. Throughout the week, there are so many in-person and virtual events taking place across the world. WHO and its fellow quadripartite organizations, FAO, UNEP, and the World Organization for Animal Health, are supporting the World AMR Awareness Week with numerous resources and campaign products. We invite active and wholehearted participation of the media in these events and your kind assistance in popularizing this campaign. Thank you. Back to you.
Thank you both very much. Do we have questions for our colleagues from FAO or WHO? Okay, I don't see that's the case. And Margaret mentions that she has shared notes, and I believe Key has done the same. So I think both of you were very comprehensive. So I'd like to thank you very much for joining us at this press briefing. And we will now move on to our last brief. Thank you very much, Margaret, as always, for joining us here. Our last brief, our friend David Hirsch from the ITU has an update for us. So I'll just leave it to you to announce. Thank you.
Rollo, just a quick scheduling announcement, if I could, that on Wednesday, 27 November next week, ITU will release the next edition of its annual Facts and Figures report. Every year, Facts and Figures provides estimates of the number of individuals that are connected to the internet. This is in support of ITU's overall objective of achieving universal and meaningful connectivity. Beyond reporting on overall global connectivity, Facts and Figures will report on the progress that is being made to bridge the world's digital divides, including those related to gender and urban-rural living. The report will also have information on issues such as internet affordability and broadband subscriptions. We hope to have an embargoed version of the report to share prior to the release. We'll be in touch on that. So just a quick announcement on that.
Okay. Thank you very much, David. Any questions, clarification for David? No? I think that was crystal clear. So thank you, as always, for joining us here, David. Okay, we're nearly done. Just a couple of announcements, as usual, just to make sure you're on the right track. We have shared with you a number of statements, as you know, from the Secretary General on his activities in Rio de Janeiro. I should at the G20 summit, and I should mention that the SG is expected to deliver remarks today at a session on sustainable development and energy transition, and we will certainly share those remarks with you as soon as we have those delivered. In terms of other statements, just to mention, or rather draw your attention to a statement that we shared with you from the Security Council on Yemen concerning the 1 year, and today is the anniversary, in fact, the 1 year mark of the unlawful detention of the Galaxy Leader crew. This is the big ship in the Mediterranean that was seized by the Houthis, the Red Sea, excuse me. So the Security Council called for the immediate release of the vessel and its 25 crew members who remain unlawfully detained for 1 year to today. So that's a statement we shared with you. We have a Committee Against Torture, which will wrap up its 81st session this coming Friday, the 22nd of November, after which it adopts the concluding observations for the following six reports it reviewed for Kuwait, Namibia, Thailand, Jordan, Mongolia, and Cameroon. So those will be adopted this coming Friday, the 22nd. We have a number of observances. As we always like to highlight the SG messages. Now, we heard a lot about children here at this briefing, sadly. And of course, on a brighter note, we heard from our colleague from WHO, but largely there's a lot of trauma that we hear about, which is really hard to listen to, but children around the globe, are facing enormous challenges. And this is precisely one of the things that the Secretary General highlights in his message, recognizing the enormous challenges that children face in our deeply divided, tumultuous, and often violent world. Quote, it's a stain on humanity's conscience when children's lives are caught in the grinding wheels of poverty or upended by disasters or violent conflicts that are killing and maiming children. This is a message from the Secretary General for Children's Day, which is observed tomorrow, the 20th of November. Today is World Toilet Day, a very important day as well. And this is there is a message to this effect, which highlights, among other things, that the toilets are fundamental to promoting human health, spurring development, and helping all people, especially women and girls, live their lives in dignity. So this is a message from the Secretary General. And lastly, tomorrow is also the 35th anniversary of Africa Industrialization Day. So there is a message to that effect, which we shared with you in the six official languages. And I have an announcement on behalf of our colleagues of the Office of the Special Envoy for Syria to mention that at 4 p.m. today, 10 a.m. New York time, 4 p.m. Geneva time, the Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, Ms. Najat Rushdie, will brief the Security Council, and her remarks will be distributed when she concludes. Lastly, but certainly not least, we have a lot of generations running around, different generation gaps in the office, rather in the building today. We have the bazaar, which many of you, the Women's Bazaar, which is taking place in the E building. So do grab some nice cuisine from the various cultures that are represented in the E building. And we all also have a meeting, which is just about to wrap up. It's a Young Activist Summit, which is really quite a nice event, which highlights the role of these young activists. Five young activists are being honored from Solomon Islands, from Bangladesh, from France, from the United States, and also from Mexico, speaking to very, very important issues on human rights, climate justice, cyber sexism, among other very, very homelessness. Lots of very important issues that these youngsters between age 19 and 30 are addressing in this important summit, which takes place here annually. It's at a tail end, but certainly if you wish to catch the last 15 or 20 minutes, do make your way over to room 18. That's it. Any questions? No. On that note, I wish you a good afternoon and see you here on Friday.